Here. She puts her hand on his chest, and he makes a goofy face because this is really very mawkish and sentimental, and they both know it.
You sticking with Jazz? You're not a bounty hunter. You don't have to be like her. You can be a soldier, but...
Again, she bites her tongue and growls past it.
You know what? You don't have to be a soldier either. I just want you to be you. And not worry about what the rest of the galaxy thinks you should be.
I think the galaxy wants me to be a crazy rich droid manufacturer living in a palace on the Outer Rim.
There again, his father's playful twinkle flickering in his eye.
Then go be that,
she says, laughing. He cups his hand to his ear.
Or maybe the galaxy is saying to become a lounge singer in a backwater space station cantina. I can belt him out.
Now, I don't know about that.
Oh, wait. I think I'm going to be a Jedi.
Now I know your brain is busted.
She gestures toward the viewscreen.
Take us down to Hana City. Gently this time, or Wedge will have your head, and maybe mine.
The arm looks, well, better, but not much. The angry redness has cooled down to a somewhat aggravated pink. The blisters have faded, but have been replaced with craters of dry, puckered skin. Sinjir's arm looks like old meat left to hang too long on a butcher's hook. At least it has all its feeling back.
He wiggles his fingers.
The skin feels uncomfortably tight. Blessedly, Nora found some painkillers.
Hello, hand, he tells his hand.
Hello, Sinjir,
he makes his hand tell him back. From around the corner of the main hold comes the sound of a door hissing open. And who should waltz out but John Burrell?
Your hair is a bit of a mess, Sinjir says.
Hmm? John's gaze rolls up, where his hair is sticking out. Oh.
Here, let me help you.
Sinjir stands, and fast as a spark is standing right in front of John. He gently begins to move the man's hair back in place.
Well, isn't this romantic?
Ah, yes. Speaking of romance, I'm really glad you brought it up, Jombi. Did you have a nice fight with our resident bounty hunter?
She knows how to, fight.
Oh, I'm sure she does.
As Sinjir continues to adjust the man's hair, one strand at a time, and by now Jom is starting to look more than a little uncomfortable, he lets a vicious fox-like grin stretch across his face.
Curious bit of trivia. As you know, when I served at the pleasure of the Empire, I served as a loyalty officer, and sometimes extracting loyalty from my fellows took a bit of doing. I learned that the human body has 434 trigger points of pain. I know it lacks humility to say, but I actually discovered another 3 all by myself. Although amending an Imperial training manual is like trying to move a boulder with a spoon, you know. All this is a very long road to a very simple destination. I am excellent at causing pain.
Jom pulls his head away from Sinjir's grooming efforts.
Are you threatening me, Rathbelus? It sure sounds that way.
I am. And for good reason. I want you to know that if you hurt Jazz Imari in any way, emotionally, physically, I mean even if you accidentally step on her foot, then I will personally make sure to find all 434... Oh, sorry... I mean 437 trigger points on your body. Are we clear?
A strange calm settles over Jom, which Sinjir finds rather unexpected. He suspected that his little speech would goad the man into fighting. Burrell seems hot-headed after all. But that's not what's happening here, is it? Instead, Jom crosses his arms and nods.
Your loyalty to her is commendable, the commando says. I'll take your,
words of wisdom under advisement. Though if I'm being honest, I suspect if anybody will get hurt in this arrangement, it'll be me.
Likely.
And that wouldn't bother you at all?
Sinjir gives a half shrug.
All right, fine. Let me ask, though. What's your deal with her? I was led to believe you and she would not be, romantically compatible.
This isn't about that. I value her tremendously. I feel connected to her. I think she's a friend. Or the closest thing to.
He says that word, friend, like it's a foreign word, in an alien tongue, whose full contextual meaning he has not yet grasped.
For a time, I thought maybe you had your eye on me.
John is just goading him,
but he decides to play along.
I did. It's the facial hair. But I'm spoken for now.
John smirks.
Really?
Really.
Good for you, mate.
Sinjir puts one more stray hair on the commando's head back in place.
Have fun with Jazz. And remember the number 437.
The halo starts to shudder. The walls are shielded, but still the sudden warmth bleeding off them is telling, even as the ship bucks along clouds, like a stone skipped across a pond.
Sounds like we're down. Better secure the prisoner, Jombi.
Landing platform OB-99.
In one direction are the rolling hills and sweeping meadows of Chandrilla.
The soft balm grass and spiky orchanthus are already returning from red to green with the coming of spring. And the sun and clouds cast shifting, shimmering shadows over the land.
In the other direction is the Silver Sea, its placid waters as calm and gray as slate. Out over the water, bands of dark clouds roll, spitting rain and pulsing lightning. Another symptom of the season shifting from winter into spring. Standing off to the side and leaning against a stack of crates is Wedge Antilles. Temin is first off the ramp, and he runs over to Antilles. The two of them clasp hands and embrace.
Hey, Snap,
Wedge says, a nickname he's given Temin because of the boy's finger-snapping habit. Bones trots after, his skeletal arms going wide.
I, too, will share an embrace with Master Antilles to simulate joy.
Wedge leans away from the hug as the droid wraps his many-jointed arms around the captain, looking less like a human sharing camaraderie and more like an insect trying to eat the face of its mate.
Okay,
the droid says. Apparently satisfied, it lets go and begins dancing around the landing platform in dramatic swoops, pliés, and pirouettes.
Sorry, Temin says, shrugging. He's trying to learn how to be more human and less singing, dancing, murder bot,
Wedge asks.
Yeah.
Bones has been Temin's bodyguard and friend now for a while. And once he rebuilt his pal from spare parts, thankfully rescuing the data brain from the New Republic soldiers who secured the Akivan Palace, he was surprised when the droid declared a desire to fit in better with the crew. Apparently it was something Sinjir said to the droid about how he creeped them all out. Temin fears that the droid's attempts have only made him more creepy, but, yay for effort.
Oh man, Wedge, you should have seen me out there. I was piloting the Halo, right? And we were swooping along the edge of Sluss and Canker's mountaintop fortress, and... All right, Snap,
Wedge says, laughing.
Ease off the throttle a minute. I need to talk to your mom. You can tell me more from the seat of my X-Wing tomorrow morning. Deal? Whoa! Yeah! Yes, deal!
Wedge has been giving Temin time in the X-Wing. He said Temin has a natural gift for piloting a fighter. Like his mother. Though Nora wasn't exactly happy about her son following in her steps as a pilot. Wedge lets the boy run training exercises out over the Silver Sea. At the time, he said to the kid,
I'm cooking up a little something called Phantom Squadron. Maybe by the time you're spaceworthy, you'd be interested in joining up.
Temin hasn't told his mother about that yet. He's not even sure that's what he wants either. Sometimes Temin's mind drifts and fantasies play out. Okay, no, he doesn't really want to be a lounge singer in some crummy cantina. But the bounty hunter life sounds pretty great. Go where you want, track down the bad guys, get paid to do it. But being a pilot gives him a thrill like no other. Cutting clouds with the scissor foils of Wedge's old X-Wing is the scariest and most amazing thing. And then again, he still misses his black market dealings on Akiva. The danger of the deal, the joy of the sale, the buzz from peddling illicit weapons, parts, and droids to thugs and criminals who might kill you for looking at them wrong. Temin doesn't know what he wants to be. He mentioned it to Sinjir a few weeks back, and the ex-Imperial shrugged. He was a bit sauced at the time on Corellian sapwine, and said,
"Nobody knows who they are or what they want, and most people just wait for everyone to tell them. Then they line up and do what they're told. My only advice is to you, boy."
He burped then, and never got around to giving the advice because he passed out. Maybe one day. For now, Temin only knows that he's so excited to get back in the cockpit, he's almost jumping out of his own skin.
Captain Antilles?
Lieutenant Wexley.
A cool breeze kicks up over the landing platform as the rain clouds drift closer. Temin circles his droid, kicking the metal skeleton in the hindquarters with his boot, and then waiting for Bones to chase after, which the droid does, like an eager friend.
Wedge smiles,
then grabs his cane and moves toward Nora, embracing her as they meet.
"Much nicer than when the droid did it,"
he says, giving her one last lingering squeeze before letting her go.
"Bones?"
she laughs.
"Oh, he's harmless." "Well, not harmless."
I get it. "How'd the mission go?"
"We bagged Getty,"
she says, looking over her shoulder. Nobody's emerged with the prisoner yet, though here comes Sinjir down the plank. Chin up, lips puckered like he's proud of himself about something.
"Off to get a pint of something,"
he calls, and then heads right for the stairway.
"Toodles!"
She thinks to call after him with some motherly admonishment, but she stays her tongue and gives Wedge a slightly embarrassed look.
"It's a rough crew, but they work. How's your treatment?"
"Physical therapy is good, and they're giving me Cerulean injections now. They say I might be in a cockpit again by the end of the year. But it's fine. I like this. I like commanding, too."
She doesn't have to possess Sinjir's gift with body language to suss out Wedge's lie.
He'd do anything to get back behind the flight stick. His whole body seems to hunger for it.
"Never mind that, Nora. There's someone who wants to..."
"We've got a problem!"
There, standing on the ramp, is John Burrell. Nora gives him a shrugging, half-irritated look, like,
"Well, go ahead, get on with it."
"It's Getty," he says. "He's dead."
The Imperial Vice Admiral's body lies there on the table in the main hold of the Halo. His lips are slick with spit froth. His skin's already gone pale and gray. Dark striations mark the brow and draw shadowy lines around the mouth and wide-open eyes. Nora is reminded how something seems truly gone when someone dies. It's not just about the little micro-movements of the body, or a chest no longer rising and falling. It's something deeper, something less tangible, less substantial. She has little cause these days to think overlong about the nature of a soul, but maybe the Force really exists. And if it does, it is gone from this body, sure as anything. It's like nothing connects it to the world anymore. It's just meat on the slab.
"Simple,"
Burrell says, solving the mystery.
He was a spicehead. He'd just taken a pinch before we took him. Wouldn't be the first addict to take too much and go sucking void, would he?
Jazz, Nora says, how hard did you knock him out?
Please, I'm a professional. I don't make mistakes like that.
Wedge scratches his head.
We'll have to do an inquiry. I'll call down and get a couple of droids to take the body to Dr. Slakartha. He'll give the body the once-over and rule out any malfeasance.
You can take the body to whoever you want. But I assure you, this man was murdered.
Jazz stoops down and gets her face near to the corpses. Cupping her hands, she scoops air near his mouth and takes a long, deep sniff.
That smell, bitter citrine, like a too ripe kakadu fruit. And see the fluid in the mouth?
She peels back his lip, already gone stiff. Saliva there has pooled, but it's neither white nor clear. It's bruised dark.
He was poisoned. Chytrogorgia, a.k.a. cerulean slime mold. It goes dry, then you powder it, and then, well, if I had a guess, someone sprinkled it in the spice tin, ensuring that he'd blissfully off himself without a clue in the world.
Wedge and Nora share a look.
He says,
I'll tell the doc. Thanks.
At least we don't need to waste time or money on a trial, John says. This guy killed a whole lot of people, sometimes poisoning whole worlds. Whoever did him in has a good sense of irony, you ask me.
Outside the ship, Nora tells Wedge,
I'm sorry, Wedge. It's our job to bring these guys in alive, not dead. I assure you, it wasn't one of us. I know I said we're a rough crew, but we're not that rough.
It's okay. I know. Whatever this was, it wasn't that.
Okay, good.
But he's still on the cusp of something.
What?
Someone wants to meet you.
Us?
The team?
Just you.
Who? And when?
Princess Leia. And she wants to meet right now.
Chapter 5.
My husband, Han Solo, is missing.
Nora blinks. Husband? Her lips move to form words, but no sound actually manifests. All she can do is stand there, gaping, gawking at the woman who singularly represents the voice of the New Republic across the galaxy. Leia Organa is a princess and a general, and, most important, a figure of inspiration that few can deny. She stands there, wearing loose-fitting white robes, somewhat traditional in the style here, with her hands clasped in front of her. The woman offered no introduction. Nora simply stepped into Leia's expansive office, which overlooks the coast of the Silver Sea, and tried to control the quivering in her voice as she announced herself.
Lieutenant Nora Wexley, you asked to see me?
All Leia said in response was that one thing.
My husband, Han Solo, is missing.
I'm sorry, Nora asks. I don't understand. If General Solo...
He's no longer a general. He resigned his military commission.
Oh, I... Leia lifts her chin, closes her eyes, and takes a deep breath. The Chandrillan air must agree with her. Her skin shines. She's like a precious stone, flawless and glowing. After a slow exhale, Leia says,
My brother taught me to center myself, to be mindful of what I'm feeling. A cup to be filled up, he says.
She winces.
And I'm just now realizing that this is likely quite sudden for you, and I'm being very rude. Hello, Lieutenant Wexley. I am Leia Organa.
She hesitates when she answers.
I'm Nora. It's a great pleasure to meet you, Your Highness. all you've done for us.
It's a strange thing to watch, but Leia has this facade, this veneer. It's not haughty, not exactly. A bit icy, certainly confident. A confidence, in fact, that borders on arrogance. It's not as if she's looking down on you, but it is very much as if she is in command of you. It's a command that is as natural as the elliptical orbit of a world around its star. As obvious and as eternal as the flow of time itself or the presence of gravity. But Nora watches that ice crack. The veneer crumbles. The tension goes out of Leia's shoulders as she leans against her desk.
Please, Nora, don't call me Highness. I have too many people who can't seem to break that habit. I just feel weird calling you Leia.
I can order you to call me Leia, if that helps.
It actually would.
Leia again stands more stiffly, as if to invoke a special formality.
Lieutenant Nora Wexley, I command you, by the power invested in me as the last Princess of Alderaan, and the Supreme High something or other of New Republic forces...
And here, Leia moves her hands about in impatient gesticulations.
And so on and so forth. I demand that you call me Leia.
Nora gives a small bow.
Thank you, Leia. I summoned you here because I have heard good things about your team. You get results. In just a few short months, you've already found half a dozen notable Imperial criminals. We brought in number 7 today, Vice Admiral Getty, but something happened. Regrettably, he didn't survive the trip. I heard about it. I'm sure that mystery will provide answers soon enough.
Leia reaches over and takes Nora's hand.
Your work is important. It tells a fractured galaxy that the New Republic is capable of delivering its own brand of law and order. And it helps us understand how all of this happened. Once we know that, we can work together to ensure that history does not repeat itself. Thank you. But I don't understand what this has to do with General, Captain Solo.
Leia pauses. Her face is like a wave about to break. There in her eyes is a war for control. As if she knows it is her job to be calm and measured. But what she really wants is to let it all loose. All the pent-up feelings. All the frustrations of running a government. All her fears and desires. She says the words slowly, carefully.
Han went missing. I need him found. And your team finds people.
You want us to find him?
You don't need to go out of your way.
Leia seems suddenly rattled.
To speak frankly, none of this is precisely above board. And you can, in turn, tell me no. This isn't me commanding you. This is me asking for your help.
She proceeds to explain what she knows.
Han and Chewbacca, his co-pilot, went on some half-cocked mission to free the Wookiee planet of Kashyyyk. But it was a ploy by the Empire. They captured Chewie, and Han barely escaped. Now he's out there alone, and his last transmission ended abruptly. And I haven't heard from him since. I fear he's in danger.
Leia pauses. Her face tightens with sorrow. But again, she pauses, takes a deep breath, and seems to swallow her grief. Nora says,
I didn't realize you two were married. It was right there on the Endor moon, after everything. We had a small ceremony, just those we trust. We don't keep it secret, but we didn't make it public either. It must be hard then, having him gone.
It is.
You know something about that, don't you?
She means Brenton. Even just thinking about him brings the memory to bear, like the bloom of heat from a crashing ship. Stormtroopers kicking down their door. The Imperial officer with a writ of arrest.
Them dragging her husband out into the night. Her comforting Temen into mourning,
assuring the boy that they'd bring Brenton back in the morning, that it was all just a mistake, that everything would be fine. That was years ago. They haven't seen Brenton since. Nora has grown woefully comfortable with the idea that her husband and Temin's father is most likely dead.
I understand. Yes,
Nora says, forcing a small smile.
Do you have any information on where Captain Solo is?
He was searching the outer rim, and he said he was close to wild space. I can send you a map of the Falcon's movements. He's far enough out there, our sensors can no longer reliably track that hunk of wonderful junk he calls a freighter.
I'll forward the map to your quarters. You can send them directly to the ship. Docking plat OB-99.
Nora pauses, then adds,
"We'll find him."
It's a promise she feels ill-equipped to make, and as soon as she makes it, the burden of the task at hand puts a tremendous weight on her. A crushing weight, in fact. But what can she say? What can she do? It's out there now. Her promise is a living thing. Leia smiles.
Warmly, truly warmly, as all the ice has melted, and nods. I believe you. Thank you, Nora Wexley. May the Force be your guide.
Chapter 6. It is not easy to sneak away from your own command. It took a bit of doing, in fact. She considered faking an illness, but these days, with all eyes on her as the identified leader of the Galactic Empire, the barest sniffle will have her swarming in nurse droids and health technicians. Instead, Rae Sloane's ruse went like this. She used her already overburdened schedule as an advantage. She told Ferrick Abdur that she had to take time to talk about fleet movements with Vice Admiral Galen, which was true enough. Galen's been asking for a meeting to discuss just that for days, no, weeks now. She sent word ahead to Galen's office that she couldn't meet today because she had a meeting with General DeVore's to discuss troop movements. That would incite the ire of Galen, but the man would take it in stride. He would swallow his impatience and toe the line as he always had. To DeVore's, she sent word that she wanted a meeting, but had to take time out to meet with Ferrick Abdur in propaganda. And so the triangle of deception was arranged. 3 points, one leading to the other. Unless someone was truly diligent about checking her whereabouts, it would seem from each to each that she had to move one meeting in favor of another. Few would seek to disturb her, lest they incite her ire. And Sloane was known for not taking that in stride. She did not toe any line. These days, she was the line, and none dared cross her. None except their mysterious fleet admiral, of course. The next step of her ruse required Adia's help. Sloane couldn't just hop into a craft and take off for regions unknown. She ran a tight ship. Accountability was king. A single ship gone missing was a breach of bureaucratic structure. And bureaucracy, vile as many considered it, was the foundation on which the entire galaxy was built. Bureaucracy would save them all. Violating that bureaucracy would upset the checks and balances. Unless, of course, Sloane had Adia change the designation and destination of a small supply ship. And so, an Imperial Lambda-class shuttle scheduled for Questel got rerouted instead to bring a load of Namite batteries and transponder arrays to the throne world of Coruscant. The pilot, a young recruit named Dasha Bowen, or so the registry says. Really, it's just a watertight identity, also put together by Adia.
"Imperial Shuttle CS-831," Sloane says into the comm. "This is transport pilot Dasha Bowen, transmitting clearance code and credentials now."
Ahead, Coruscant glows brightly. A massive world, carved with lines of light. The geometric patterns of its planet-encompassing Ecumenopolis giving it the look of being on the edge of breaking apart. As if a frozen moment in time captures it seconds before it glows, swells, and detonates.
That may be truer than I care to admit, she thinks.
The throne world of the Empire is in the midst of being pulled apart. Not so dramatically as having its mantle shattered, no, but its populace is undergoing that kind of tectonic shift. The citizens in some sectors have risen up against the Empire, while others have instead fought against their insurgent neighbors. A veritable civil war. One whose flames are stoked nicely by the New Republic resistance fighters entrenched on the surface. They sow distrust. Chaos is the result. All around her little cargo ship, a defensive armada forms a protective shield around the planet. These are ISB ships, Imperial Security Bureau, not the Navy. Admiral Rax was very clear on that point. He said that they were not to commit resources protecting the throne world. The ISB is controlling this world, and the Navy doesn't want any part of it. It shows the fractures in the Empire, all the broken pieces drifting apart.
It is a symbol, he told her, of our indolence and torpidity. It is the mouldering core of our overripe fruit, and I wish to cut away such rot so as to preserve our sweet remains, and, of course, the seeds within.
She argued that saving Coruscant would be a better symbol. He answered with,
It is a far greater consequence to show how much we are willing to lose to preserve the strength of our empire.
It was then that he echoed the words of Count Vidian.
Forget the old way.
Was this echo deliberate? How would he know what Vidian told her?
We must discard the obvious choices, Admiral Sloane. We must forge our own path through the stars, if we are to survive.
And with that, the argument was done. Now she hovers above the world. A world they have willfully forgotten. One left to the ISB, under the command of Palpatine's old administrator, Grand Vizier Mas Amida. She wonders idly what it would take to retake the planet. The New Republic could fairly easily wipe out the ISB's defensive blockade. It would take time, but reports arrive daily of the Republic's growing military might. Still, the Empire's presence here on the surface is deeply dug in. An aerial campaign wouldn't be enough. Finally, her comm crackles, and a response returns.
Code checks out. Cleared for landing, CS-831.
Of course it does, she thinks.
Adia knows what she's doing. Dasha Bowen sets the ship for a landing trajectory.
Sloane leaves the cargo ship behind on the landing platform. Droids move to unload the very real technical parts from inside its hold. While they are occupied, she pulls her visor low. The visor both hides her face and, with the tap of a button on the side of the helmet, pulls up a heads-up display, glowing on the plastoglass shield. In this case, it's a map of Coruscant. Her destination is a pulsing red star on the map. The old Hall of Imperial Register building, less affectionately known as the Pit. It is a storehouse of deeds, records, and data dumps. It is to most a worthless aggregation of the Empire's bureaucracy. As records pile up in ships and transports and nav computers across offices and academies and depots, those records must occasionally be offloaded to backup, and so they are dumped here, off-site. Often by a droid. Few care to come here, for combing through the information is an act not unlike trying to find one particular grain of sand on a windswept beach. Worse, the information is often quite valueless. Trajectory calculations, inventory lists, personnel records all fill the massive warehouse of data. But it's that last bit she's looking for. Personnel records. If there's anything about Gallius Rax, it will be here.
That is, if she can find it. Thankfully, Sloane is quite adept at navigating this place. To others, it is a pit. To her, it is a temple. The pit sits at the margins of the Verity District, a well-fortified imperial part of Coruscant, home to the Hall of Adjudication, the Institute to Preserve Imperial History, and the ISB Academy and offices. The streets here are usually clean, well-kept, and busy. But now, not so much. She passes a pair of stormtroopers sitting against the steel barricade, helmets off their heads and held between their legs. The two men are sweaty, tired, and staring off at nothing. Ahead, the street is scarred with starburst streaks of char. The plastercrete shattered and cracked as if by thermal detonator. It's quiet, too. Usually she'd hear the thrumming, vibrant traffic of the city above her. Speeders and grav bikes whipping past in crisscrossing lines like little myrmidons serving their colony. Now, though, the sky above is dead. Not a single speeder. No droids, no birds, nothing. The airspace is closed, isn't it? She'd heard reports of citizens loading up their speeders with explosives and driving them into Imperial buildings. Then, as if on cue, the ground shudders. Somewhere off in the distance, just such an explosion. She can feel it vibrate up through her heels, all the way into her teeth. Sloane can't see anything, but it isn't long before she sees the trail of red smoke climbing into the sky like a crawling serpent. Klaxons go off. A pair of ISB speeders streak overhead. What a horror show, she thinks. But Ray has no time to dwell on this. Her time here is limited, and she has to move. The pit is ahead. From the surface, it looks like nothing but a single-story fortified bunker. It has a single door and a shuttered window. As Sloane approaches, the shutter slides up with a rattle-bang. There stands the top half of an administrative droid, its capsule-shaped head leaning forward. From its mouthpiece comes a tinny, mechanized voice.
Hold still for ocular scan!
Sloane can't hide from this. No matter how well-crafted the persona of Dasha Bowen, Adia's efforts do not carry as far as creating a whole new pair of eyeballs. This one will not be faked, and so she lifts her visor. From the droid's own eye comes a shimmering red beam. She blinks and winces as it passes over her face.
Grand Admiral Ray Sloane, it is good to see you. Welcome to the Hall of Imperial Register. Please watch your step. The fall is quite steep.
The droid is right. The pit is 50 floors. Not straight up, but rather straight down. Plunged into the exomantle of Coruscant like a pneumatic bolt. The shape of it is circular, and it spirals ineluctably downward, giving Sloane the sense that she is swirling down the drain. At the bottom, she half expects that the Hall of Imperial Register gobbles you right up like a mouth, a sarlacc nesting at the nadir, digesting wayward data miners. She will not be digested. Not today. She will, however, go mad if she doesn't get moving. Inertia is a curse, and Sloane's whole life and career have been about combating it. So she sets up shop in a little alcove. Hours pass. The droid attendants, more administrative droids, these fixed to the railings so that they can zip past the shelves of records, both hard copy and digital, bring her old data cartridges. She told them that she needed a proper accounting of all the ships of the Imperial Navy in play as of the destruction of the second Death Star. She's on her eighth and final cartridge. She starts with the Dreadnoughts, the Superstar Destroyers. 13 were in service before the revivified Death Star was destroyed above Endor. One of those is the Ravager, the SSD from which Sloane rules the Empire. And which, strictly speaking, is now Galen's command. One of those is the Executor, Vader's command ship. The Executor was lost that day, plunging into the surface of the Death Star, taking hundreds of thousands of the best Imperials with it. Sloane shudders as she thinks of it.
that leaves 11 others. 3 are now in the hands of the New Republic. 2 of those were from admirals willingly surrendering the ship and its people. 1 was taken forcibly by New Republic forces while it underwent repairs over Kuat. 5 were destroyed outright in battles across the galaxy with the New Republic. The ships were understaffed, underprotected, and on the run. The dreadnoughts are home to massive batteries of fleet-killing weapons, yes, but are also slow, unwieldy beasts. They hang there in the sky like bricks. And without adequate protection, it is an inevitability that enemy forces could erode the ships until obliteration ensues. 1 was taken by pirates. The Annihilator. Tag's old ship. But who controls the Annihilator now? The reports don't say. Another, the Arbitrator, made a bad hyperspace calculation to escape pursuing NR ships. It evaporated when it was sucked into a gravity well. That leaves Palpatine's own command ship, the Eclipse. Records show that it, too, was destroyed by a fleet of New Republic vessels. Akbar's own frigate, Home One, firing the ship-killing shot. Ah, but there's the catch. And it's why Sloane is here. The ships dumped data across the stars, transmitting pulses of information to this location. That provides a black box recording of information, so one could discern what exactly happened before a ship was destroyed, captured, or surrendered. All the other tracking data adds up to the known fates of each SSD. Their stories match the data for all of them, except one. For the Eclipse, the data ends a full day cycle before the ship was reportedly destroyed. It shows no siege by New Republic forces. It simply drops off the star map. Gone. Vanished. Sloane concedes that it's possible the ship stopped reporting due to a malfunction in its data recorder, though redundant systems were supposed to alert command if that had happened. Again, bureaucracy and reiterative mechanisms should have saved the day here. And yet they didn't. Is it possible that the Eclipse is still out there? Could the Ravager not be the last Super Star Destroyer in the naval arsenal? The inventory of the Star Destroyers is similar, but on a far grander scale. 75% of the Star Destroyers in service before Endor can capably be tracked to similar fates. Destroyed, captured, lost in confirmable if curious ways. But a full quarter of those ships cannot be accounted for. Records show fateful ends that contradict their black box recordings. Does the Empire have more ships than she knows? Ghost fleets out there somewhere? Are they operating independently? Had they been captured or abandoned? Something else may be going on. Does Rax know? Or is he in the dark too? Speaking of Gallius Rax, picking through the data to find anything on the erstwhile fleet admiral will be an act of finding a precious gem in a box of broken glass. It will be a slow and miserable retrieval. But it's why she's really here. So she summons a droid and sets it to work.
I will see what data I can excavate,
the droid says, then gives a small nod before its servo motors whir and carry it away.
Excavate,
she thinks. A perfect word, and from a droid, no less. Flip, flip, flip. Page after page on the cartridge reader, she palms the control orb and swipes it left again and again, scrolling through endless administrative pages. Here, as with the naval archives, the presence of Rax is naught but a vapor trail. She's chasing shadows. And so she's down to searching the records of those who associated with him. Ilaren, Rancid, Screed, and Palpatine himself. She cross-references personnel reports, genealogical records, inventory lists, anything, everything. Hours pass. Her eyes are bleary. She feels alone and overwhelmed. And the only sound that accompanies her frustration and her anxiety is the sound of droids clicking and clacking and rattling about. She stands up. The search is over. Rex barely exists. Trying to figure out who he is or who he was is an act of grabbing at fog. It dissipates in your hand while still obscuring everything beyond it. It's time to go. So she packs up her notes and tucks them in a side satchel before slinging it over her shoulder. Suddenly, movement behind her. She wheels on it, reaching for her blaster. It's the droid. Of course it is. It wouldn't be anyone else. And yet, well, she has to excuse her own shock. I'm tired and angry. The droid buzzes.
An image crystal.
It extends a telescoping arm. In it, a small smoke-gray crystal. The Empire doesn't use these anymore, as they're somewhat antiquated. But decades before, single-serving image crystals were still in use. Now the Empire has the ability to archive visual and textual information across cartridges or data cards. She's about to hand it back. What could one image matter? Still, the reader is right here. She unslings the bag and, without sitting, places the crystal in the smooth portal on the alcove desk, then hits the button beneath it so it lights up. A three-dimensional image emerges in the space before her. It looks like somewhere in an Imperial docking bay. In the background, a Lambda-class shuttle sits. At the margins of the hollow, white-armored stormtroopers and a pair of red-armored Imperial Royal Guardsmen. There, in the middle of the photo, Wolf Yularen, Dodd Rancet, Terranald Screed, plus three others. Grand Vizier Mos Amida, Emperor Palpatine, and a boy. Or rather, a boy on the cusp of being a young man. The boy looks like a dirt-cheeked rube, shoved into an ill-fitting academy uniform. His hair is dark. His skin is pale. Those eyes, though. A familiar arrogance shines there. Each a black hole swallowing the light. One thing stands out. One of the boy's hands is facing outward. And Sloane sees something across his palm. A marking of some kind. A tattoo? Or a brand? This holographic image by itself does nothing to illuminate who Rax is. And yet it stirs in her a strange kind of hope. In this act of excavation, she has found a rather curious fossil, hasn't she? If this is him, if this is Gallius Rax, then the mystery of his presence becomes one she can solve. He becomes a beast she can kill. Not literally, of course. Or so she hopes. What next, then, for this mystery? She has a bit of thread in her hands. How shall she pull it? Four of the men in the image glowing before her are dead. Palpatine is gone. Yularen died on the Death Star. Rancet perished in a rebel attack. Though she's heard rumors that Vader executed him for treason. And Screed was killed by pirates off the Iktari Circle, which leaves one left alive. It is time, she thinks, to pay Mos Amida a visit.
Interlude. Coronet City. Corellia.
Erno watches the kid do it. The little dum-dum doesn't even know he's being watched. Kid creeps up to the wall like a scuttling spider under the cover of night, then takes the stencil to the pale brick and pulls out the light painter. He shakes it a few times and gives it a hit, and then it pulses an image onto the side of the PNS station. Peace and security. An iconic image of a bad, bad man. Maybe not even a man. Maybe a machine. Vader lives, it says. That's stenciled underneath the all-too-familiar artist rendering of the helmeted thug. The kid turns, grinning like he got away with it. He didn't. Erno steps into the halo of light from the street orb overhead. and he clears his throat so the kid in the dark hood and cloak looks up. Another one of these acolyte idiots. Erno whistles.
Nice art. Real original.
The kid doesn't say anything. He stands there quaking in his bare feet. He's young, dumb, scared. Erno sighs and levels his blaster.
Come on, you little roach rat. Turn around, turn around. Let's get these binders on.
Pouting, the boy turns and Erno slaps on a pair of binders, then hauls him around front and in through the doors of the station. The new hire at the front desk, a pretty Pantoran named Kaisa, says,
"Hey, detective."
And he gives her a wink and a nod, even though she'd probably never have anything to do with a scruffy, thick neck like him. Erno drags the kid through the station and past the desks and the hollow screens and the peace officers and into one of the back rooms. He gives the kid a light shove, and the boy lands hard in a chair. The boy hisses something at him. It isn't in a language he understands, and he doesn't care to ask about it.
Uh-huh, sure, whatever, kid.
Erno sits down across from the boy and pops a cut square of rubber root in his mouth, giving it a good chew. It tastes like the underside of a boot, but gives his mouth something to do, and better this than the stim sticks he used to smoke. He gets the boy's measure fast. Human punk. Maybe 14, maybe 15. Pale like the others. They pretend they're nocturnal. Black hood, black cloak. This one doesn't have a mask, though. A lot of these acolyte freaks, they put together these masks, hammering together plastoid, metal, wood, goggles, ventilators, whatever, and wear them as they harangue the locals. It's all pathetic, paltry stuff. Vandalism, mostly.
Vader lives, Erno says, chawing on the rubber root. Vader lives, you say? Last I heard, he went up with the Death Star. Boom. He's dead. If he was ever even alive. Empire's falling apart. And it wouldn't be if he was still around, don't you think?
Death isn't the end.
Last I checked, it's pretty much the final stop, kid.
The boy grins. His teeth are white. Too white. His tongue snakes along them. And for a moment, Erno feels his guts clench. His instincts are telling him something's wrong here, but he doesn't know what.
No, this kid's just getting to you. It's late. You've been on duty for too long now. Get this moron booked and head home. What's your name?
Oblivion.
He snorts with derisive laughter.
Oh, that's a nice name. That a family name?
The loser doesn't say anything. He just sits there, chest rising and falling like a cornered feral animal.
Look, kid, I got you for vandalism. You can spend a couple nights down in the hole. But I'm feeling friendly. I'm feeling generous. You roll over on a couple of your acolyte buddies. You are an acolyte of the beyond, right? And I'll get you out of here with a stern finger wagging and not much else, hmm?
Still, the boy says nothing. Erno sighs.
What's the deal with you pouty little thugs anyway? You what, a bunch of suck-ups for the Empire?
Not the Empire. Something greater than the Empire.
Vader?
The boy grins.
Not Palpatine.
Again, the boy says nothing. That grin only widens. Makes sense, Erno figures. Who would think that old withered twig was worth a measure of twisted hero worship? Vader at least looked like a tough guy. Imposing, dangerous, a real bad bag of tricks.
You don't have a mask?
Erno asks.
I don't.
Why not? The mask is more of the Vader thing, huh? Trying to look like him? You know he was a bad guy, right?
Are you a decent man?
The boy asks.
A good guy?
Hardly, Erno thinks.
His wife has left him for a pair of artists in the Tino Village District. His neighbors think he's a slob. Even the fish in his fish tank give him a dubious look every morning when he leaves for work.
I asked about your mask.
The boy shifts in his seat.
You have to earn your mask.
Oh! You haven't earned it yet?
The kid looks up at the ceiling, then around the room at the bare walls.
This building is very old.
Yeah? So?
I know what's downstairs.
What's downstairs? The museum next door uses the shared basement with the P&S building. The detectives keep evidence locked up down there. And the museum uses the same lockup to keep a bunch of old, musty, dusty artifacts and the like. Erna's about to pick this apart, because really, why does this snot-dribbling punk care? Maybe it's a clue. Maybe the kid's parents work for the museum. Could be a... But then, someone comes in the room. It's a security officer. Spob Rydell, hat in hand.
Erno, you ought to see this! I'm busy, Rydell,
he thinks. But fine, fine. If one of the security ops guys wants him to see something, so be it. He takes the kid's wrists and brings them to the tabletop before slapping a button underneath the surface. The table goes magnetic, and the kid's binder cuffs thud hard to the tabletop as the magnetic field pulls them down. Then he's up and back through the station. The hollow screens are turning to CCI, the Coronet City Info Channel, one by one. It takes Erno a second to gauge what he's even seeing. Hollow feeds from various areas around the city all show similar scenes. Downtown in Diadem Square, a horde of hooded and cloaked figures are mobbing storefronts and leaping on top of the air tucks to pull the speeders down to the ground. On the one line of the maglevel subway, they swarm aboard as soon as the train stops at the Juni Street station. Down by the casinos, they rush those coming out and going in, dark cloaks fluttering in the night. They carry sticks, sticks painted red. They have masks. Some kind of concerted attack. A riot. Or worse. Already the officers here are mobilizing, streaming out the door or heading up the stairs to the speeder pad on the roof.
It's the Griffin Acolytes,
Rydell says.
Ain't you got one in the back room there? Bring his narrow can out here. Let's kick it around a little.
Yeah, yeah, Erno thinks. He stomps to the back room he was in, throws the doors wide, and the kid is gone. Just then, the lights flicker once, then twice, then go out. Erno is in darkness. Thankfully, a few seconds later, the emergency lights come up. They line the floor and the ceiling, casting everything in a red glow. He curses under his breath and heads back out into the main room, and already most of the building is cleared out. It's him, Rydell, a couple of other detectives like Shreen and Mersey, and... Wait, wasn't Kaiser here? Where the hell'd she go? He's about to say something to Rydell, but then a blaster shot threads the air, clipping the officer square in the forehead. Rydell falls backward. Two more blasts, and Shreen and Mersey fall. Shreen flips backward over her desk, and Mersey just slumps forward against a hydro cooler. Erno fumbles at his back for his own blaster, but he's too slow. There's Kaiza. Kaiza, of all the people. She has a standard sec-issued blaster pointed up and at him. The kid in black is nowhere to be seen.
Kaiza, I don't get what's happening here, doll.
I'm not your doll.
Her voice trembles as she speaks.
What is this?
She slowly crosses the space between them, winding her way through the sea of desks, through the red-lit half-dark.
This is a revolution. This is the revenge of the darkness. This is oblivion.
Fucking hell,
Erno says.
You're one of them?
He figures she's not trained. She's scared. He can hear that much in her voice. So he goes for his blaster anyway.
He's old, but she's not a cop. His hand finds his blaster, and his arm extends. The air lights up next to him. The world thrums as a red beam of light whisks upward through all his face. A searing line of pain across his wrist. And then, the hand that held the blaster is gone. It thumps against one of the desks, still clutching the blaster. He watches it fall and tumble away. It's an absurd thing to see your own hand coming off like that. Next to him, it's the kid in the cloak. He has a red-bladed lightsaber in his hand.
I told you I knew what was in the basement,
he sees.
That's the blade we've been looking for?
Kaisa asks him. The acolyte gives an over-eager nod. Then, Kaisa clubs Erno in the side of the head. The world spins away from him as he tumbles to the floor. She bends down and whispers in his ear.
Theta lives, and so do you. Tell everyone the acolytes are coming, doll.
Chapter 7.
The bar is a little seaside joint off Janari Point, a few clicks outside Hana City proper. It's not much to look at. A round bar of dark wood under a wind-ruffled tent. Bula birds strut about the pebbles and sand, their star-tipped beaks overturning rocks to look for their next meal to come skittering out. The ocean slides in and out, with less of the crash and clamor of proper waves, and more the hiss and whisper of a calm lake lapping at its shore. The night is cool. The spitting rain is done, leaving behind a breeze. Sinjir sits, staring into a white mug of black liquid, steam rising around him, warming his chin. Tonight the bar has a few other patrons, other Chandrillans over there, an angler with a firm chin staring down at her pint of fizzing something or other. On the other side, a young man in a fancy, breezy shirt, glaring at his holoscreen with grave disinterest. The bartender, a tall woman with her white blonde hair pulled back in a complex braid that loops around her neck like a collar, eases past, asking,
"Everything good?"
He gives a small nod. As she passes, he sees her gaze turn up. She spies someone coming, someone behind Sinjir. He's about to tense up, and then, half a second later, an arm slides around his neck on the right side and on his left. A scruffy and familiar head appears on his shoulder, sandy beard scratching his collarbone.
"Well, hello,"
Sinjir says, arching an eyebrow. The man's free hand snakes over Sinjir's right shoulder and grabs the mug, then pulls it to his head so he can sniff it.
"This is Cav,"
the man says with a frown.
"What?"
Sinjir says, feigning shock.
"Cav? Well, I didn't order this. I must burn this place down in protest. It is the only recourse."
The man, Condor Kyle, rolls his eyes.
"You're very dramatic. I'm just surprised you're drinking this and not, say, Kowakian rum. Or, I don't know, hull stripper. I'm trying to stay awake to see you. Hence the calf."
He holds up the mug and leers over its lip.
"Oh, and I'll have you know that Hull Stripper was my nickname at the Imperial Officers' Academy."
"I don't doubt that."
Condor leans in to kiss Sinjir's cheek. Alarm bells go off inside his head. Reflexively, he pulls his face to the side. He scoots his stool a few centimeters away from the man.
"That can't be good,"
Condor says.
"You done with me so soon?"
"Now who's being dramatic?"
"So what is it, then?"
"I told you. I don't like this."
"This?"
"This! This, the public thing."
Condor hip-bumps a stool closer to Sinjir, then plops down on it. His elbow plants on the bar, and he leans against his hand, his face twisting into a dubious, bemused mask.
You do know where you are, right? You're safe here, Rathvelis. We're safe here. Chandrila is pretty open.
Condor exists on that perfect line between pretty and manly. He's got a barrel chest and big arms, a laser-shorn scalp, and that patchy, spiky beard of his. But he's also got long, theatrical lashes and pouty lips, and skin as smooth and tan as a statue carved of Nemorian Corabaster. Even his voice. It's gravelly, but it has a lilt to it, too. It is rough, but beautiful music. He's also one of the best slicers the New Republic has on deck. Not many systems Kyle can't cut to ribbons if he sets his mind to it. That's how he and Sinji are met. 2 jobs back, hunting Moff Gorgon. The crew needed someone to break into an interrogator droid's head, and Temmin wasn't up to the task. They brought in Condor Kyle. Condor, whom Sinjir just publicly rebuked.
It's not that, Sinjir says. Not exactly. The Empire... Well, he's explained this all before, hasn't he?
Condor knows the deal. The Empire cared little about any sexual or romantic entanglements, provided they didn't have to see it. No matter what your peccadilloes... The Manual of Decorum made it clear that you kept all of that behind closed doors, especially if it violated any of the Empire's